Lawmakers compromised. Will voters weigh in? From SDPB, today is Friday, April 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a conversation with Representative Will Mortensen. We'll talk about the nuances of Senate Bill 201 and what happens next with the future of South Dakota development. Don't touch that fossil. We'll get to know a ranger and paleontologist from Badlands National Park. We've got hot tips for being a responsible citizen scientist. We have poetry for National Poetry Month, courtesy of South Dakota poet Joseph Bottom. Plus, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra celebrates the season finale. We welcome Maestro Delta David Geyer. That's coming later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A generational ranch in Pierrepont offers visitors a unique agritourism opportunity. The couple running the operation say educating the public on beef and agriculture is vital now more than ever. SDPB's Evan Walton reports.
A South Dakota ranch with generational roots offers a unique experience for tourists interested in learning where their food comes from. Clint and Kelly Brandley own and operate Back 40 Beef, LLC. Clint is a fifth-generation farmer and rancher whose ancestors settled in South Dakota.
Our family immigrated here back in 1886 from Germany and Norway. Settled in the prairie pothole region of the Coteau Hills here. Been farming the same ground, you know, for the last 100 and some years. Farm with my dad and my mom, and also my wife Kelly, who has an off-the-farm job. And then we have two daughters.
The Brandleys currently farm corn, soybeans, alfalfa, and run an Angus cattle operation of 300 cows. They also offer an annual adventure farm with a 12-acre corn maze that offers educational facts on beef and agriculture. Visitors get a close-up with farm animals, crawl through a hay tunnel, and experience local food trucks. Clint Brandley says it's important to educate the public on where their food comes from while incorporating local businesses in the process.
People nowadays are four generations removed from the farm and have literally no idea how their food is made, how it's grown, and what goes on a typical farm nowadays. So we came up with the idea of corn maze. So out in the corn maze, we have different checkpoints that are sponsored by local businesses because we really wanted to include the area, because go around from town to town, you know, main streets are shrinking, they're kind of dying, but you know, there's still businesses here, so we really want to still promote local businesses.
The Brandleys were awarded Advocates of the Year by Agriculture United for South Dakota in 2021. The award recognized the Brandleys' work in sharing agricultural information in their communities and volunteering in an Adopt-a-Farmer program, which provides outreach to students. While participating in the program, Kelly Brandley decided nothing should be wasted in the processing of their cattle. So, she started creating beef tallow and soy wax blended candles. She says the candles reduce overall waste and help her family farm reach into a new market.
From a beef animal, we get the things that we eat, like steak, hamburger, and all the roast, all that good stuff. But then we also take the fat and we use it for things like this in our cosmetics. Also, like, beef is used widely in pharmaceuticals to help with curing illnesses or medicines. And so nothing goes to waste in beef. And so I thought, I don't want this beef fat to go to waste, so we're going to use it.
She says expanding into a new market and offering public education on beef and agricultural facts follows the why of their operation.
Our why is the future, our kids. So we have this farm and we want to be able to have it for our daughters if they decide that they ever want to come back and farm, and we want to have options for them. So by doing the corn maze, by having maybe doing something with the tallow candles and selling the beef, hopefully we can get to a point where if both of our daughters want to come back, we can have them both.
The Brandleys operate their adventure farm and corn maze the weekend after Labor Day through the last weekend of October. I'm SDPB's Evan Walton in Pierrepont.
As South Dakota's summer tourism season kicks off in earnest, we are checking in across the state on popular attractions and off-the-beaten-path adventures. Let's say you are walking along a ridge at the geologic marvel that is Badlands National Park, and something catches your eye. It's a rock that's maybe a bit shinier or a darker color from the rest of the rock bed, and it's a peculiar shape. Well, you may have stumbled upon a fossil. Now, what do you do next as a responsible citizen scientist? We're going to learn more from Madison Shiro, a park ranger, paleontologist, and geologist. I talked with her earlier this week. We'll start with the park's long tradition of paleontology.
So Badlands, when it was founded, actually a big part of the reason we were initially protected as a national park was because we're one of the richest fossil beds in the world, especially for the timeline of Earth history that we represent, which is from about 37 to 28 million years ago. There've been paleontological expeditions that have been coming out to the Badlands area for over 100 years. So there's also just a whole history and tradition of paleontology.
Take us back pre-100 years, because indigenous people have been also discovering fossilized records long before any kind of contact was made. What do we know about that time and some of those discoveries?
We have, we have evidence of stone tools going back about 12,000 years. And a lot of those are made out of a mineral called chalcedony, which is something that is not really found in this area. It's found mostly in the South Uinta Badlands National Park, and that's it. And we see evidence of those being traded far and wide. The indigenous people that were out here were the first paleontologists that explored this land, truly. We have really, really neat stories of finding remains of Mosasaurus, the giant sea lizard, or Chief Red Cloud, who has a connection to Agate Fossil Beds National Monument in Nebraska, working with one of the early paleontologists, one of the early European paleontologists who came out this way to kind of show him around, show some of the fossils. And one of the names of one of our most iconic creatures actually comes from Chief Red Cloud, and that's the Brontothere, or the Thunder Beast is what it kind of translates to.
What kind of research are you doing? What's your interest area?
So my research has kind of focused on describing this specimen of this little teeny tiny deer from the Oligocene, so about 32 million years ago. And when I say tiny, it's like a 3 to 5 pound deer. Absolutely adorable. There was a skull of one of these found in 2016 by an intern at the park on her first day out exploring. And so she did the right thing. She left it where it was, took photos, and reported it to us. When we excavated it, we realized that it's not the typical species of tiny deer that we see in the park. So somebody needed to describe it and write it up. And so I decided to take up that project. Like my co-authors and I, the more detail we got into looking into like the anatomical differences in the teeth and the skull of this thing, we realized it doesn't match up with anything else we've ever seen. And it shares traits from two different genera, one that comes before it and one that comes after it in time. So it's intermediate, most likely, between the two of those. So we actually had to end up naming a new genus. And that paper is supposed to come out any day now.
Nice. All right, we're going to have you back on when that research is in the world. But you said something that I think a lot of people will be tuned in on, which is this idea that something is left to be discovered. And as citizens, we might be part of a discovery if you're in the Badlands. And then if you see something, what is the responsible thing to do?
Yes, this is my favorite thing to talk about. So the cool thing about Badlands is that, yes, there are tons of fossils left to be found, and it's not going to stop. As we're eroding away, new fossils are constantly being uncovered. And the Badlands erodes at about 1 inch per year on average across the park, which may not necessarily sound like a whole lot, but the Black Hills, for example, erode 1 inch every 10,000 years. We're 1 inch almost every single year.
Wow.
So we're finding fossils constantly. Not just us, visitors as well. In fact, a huge number of our fossil finds are found by visitors. We get about 300 to 400 reports per year now. So if you're down at Badlands and you're exploring around, it's a great idea to keep an eye on the ground as you're going. And if you want to get a good idea of what to look for, I think the easiest thing to do is stop by the Ben Riffle Visitor Center and check out our fossil preparation lab. Because we've got tons of fossils in there. We have photos of fossils still in the ground so that you can start to train your brain and get an idea of what these things look like. Because the bones do have a kind of similar color to the rock. So they can be a little tricky to spot, but there is a textural difference. They're usually a little bit shinier. They're going to be cracked in a different way. Fossil teeth are really what stands out here because they're either a dark brown or black color. We super value citizen science at Badlands, and we've got this great visitor site report program in place. So if you do find a fossil, it's super important to do simple things. First and most important is leave it exactly where it is. If a fossil is removed from its original context, we can't do anything with it. We have to have the scientific context. We have to know which rock layer it came from. We can't tell how old it is. We can't tell if there was anything else around it. Plus, if you remove it, there's a chance it could get improperly removed. You got to leave that one up to the paleontologist, right? Step number two is take photos and get GPS coordinates. Super helpful to us if you can have something for scale in the photos. And then it's also great to get photos of your surroundings too, the views you're seeing, not just the fossil itself on the ground. Third thing to do is just report it. So you can do that a couple of ways. You can come down to the Ben Rifle Visitor Center or the White River Visitor Center and report it in person with a ranger. Or you can submit your report to badlands_fossils_finds@nps.gov, as in nationalparkservice.gov. But if you do come report it in person, we're going to give you a cool fossil finder patch and try to get your photo up on our wall of fame in the lab if you want.
What are some of the safety things for people who are getting excited about doing a little fossil exploration? We want them to be safe. What's your advice?
Yeah, huge, huge question there, because obviously rangers want you to be prepared, right? Yeah. And Badlands can be difficult terrain. And first I should say that in most national parks, you're required to stick to the trails. But Badlands is actually what we call an open hike park, so you're allowed to walk anywhere you want. I also like to remind visitors that you can fall off of anything you want or get lost anywhere you want, which we don't want to happen. So you just have to keep your own safety in mind. But as you're out there exploring, especially if you're here during the summer, bringing a buddy is super important. Anybody else who can come with you. But the most important thing is water. We recommend a gallon of water per person per day, especially in the summer, gets to ridiculously high temperatures. And with the winds we have out here sometimes, it's kind of a dangerous combo because your sweat dries right off and you don't realize you're getting dehydrated. And then it's not fun from there. Also, the terrain itself, the rocks are very loose and crumbly. One of the reasons we erode so fast. So you want to be careful. Most of the injuries we have in the park are minor trips, slips, and falls. And then things like cacti. Don't put your hand down on one. I've done that.
All right. Well, be prepared. Stop by that visitor center so you know what to look for. Leave things there. Take a photo. Make a report. And get home safely so you can go have the adventure again. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Legislation regarding carbon capture pipelines in South Dakota was one of the most controversial issues lawmakers tackled this year. The legislature passed Senate Bill 201, positioned as a compromise between opposing parties and a protection for landowner rights. Still, a group of concerned citizens is gathering signatures to refer that law to voters in the fall. House Majority Leader Will Mortensen stopped by the SDPB studios for an in-depth conversation about the legislation.
It makes sure that if these carbon pipelines come, and that's a decision that's up to the PUC, it's not made by the legislature or anybody else like it has been for 50 years, but if these carbon pipelines come, that they're on terms that are friendlier to our counties and they're friendlier to our landowners that are, you know, across which these pipelines might be coming, and that they're set up so that they can benefit farmers and the state broadly and not just a particular industry or particular pipeline company. That is, I don't know if this pipeline is coming ultimately, but we want to make sure that it comes on fair and positive terms for our landowners and our counties if it does.
And now this has already been referred to the voters. Where are we at in that process?
There was an announced effort to try to repeal it through referendum. I think folks are out gathering signatures, which they have several months to do. I don't know if that will ultimately come to fruition or not, but I think it's important that we have this discussion as a state, even though this pipeline would only be coming through, I think it's 10 or 14 counties or something like that in the state, because I do think it's an opportunity that we can have development here, that things can still get built in this state, but that are on terms that are fair to these landowners, and that it didn't affect the primary issue being eminent domain. And I think that's a principal frustration of the folks who want to repeal this bill, is that they were frustrated that eminent domain wasn't addressed in it. Again, I don't know if this pipeline's coming, but if it is, we darn sure want these landowner bill of rights in place.
So first comment from opponents is that it tackles too many things. It violates the single subject rule. You disagree with that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, and that was discussed in the House floor. It's not really a close call from the perspective of our Constitution. Our Constitution rightly says you can only have one subject, and this is. The only subject here is citing these linear projects. Mm-hmm. And so, like dozens of laws, even this year that have been passed, that doesn't mean it can only have one section. Or that doesn't mean it can only do one discrete thing. It just has to be about one subject. And in this case, that's how we're going to cite these pipelines in South Dakota when they come.
All right. Second criticism is that you capitulated to the pipelines in the sense that the PUC can overrule a county's ordinances. So if a county says, hey, the setbacks have to be here, or if a county says, we don't want this here at all, now the PUC can say, no, we're going to, if it's overly burdensome, we can overrule it. And your response to that?
The language you just quoted is current law. That is, the PUC currently has the ability to call balls and strikes on which local laws are going to be given effect as it pertains to linear projects. So just a little bit of vocab for your listeners, but a linear project would be something that is crossing our entire state. Think of like an interstate highway. As an interstate comes across our state, across multiple different counties, we don't have a different speed limit in every county. And of course, that would be ridiculous if you're going 80 and then you're going 45 and then you're going 65. So there's good reasons why for projects that are crossing our entire state, we have consistent regulation. Under the Landowner Bill of Rights bill that passed the legislature, the PUC still has authority, as it has for 50 years, to say, you have to follow this local ordinance, you don't have to follow this local ordinance. When it's something that's only in one county, then that county should be able to hammer away and pass whatever ordinances it wants. When it's crossing the whole state, I really do think the state has an interest in having pretty consistent regulations. I just think that makes good common sense.
What is new in this legislation that you believe addresses landowner concerns and serves to protect them?
Mm-hmm. Additional compensation is the first and most obvious thing. I mean, that's the thing that I would tell you the pipeline companies did not like at all, that I had to fight like heck with them to get included and keep included. And so they're going to be paying millions of additional dollars each year, half of which go to the counties, half of which go to the landowners. So that's a benefit, maybe not a protection. There's also 10 or so protections that are contained in this statute. And a lot of those are from indemnity, which says if they cause any harm to your crops, they have to pay for it. If they harm your drain tile, they have to pay for it. For the counties, if they harm your road, they have to pay for it. Those are things that I would say largely this pipeline company was offering as part of voluntary easements. We don't know, though, whether they would ever be included if eminent domain were invoked. That is, when it's a voluntary, two willing parties on both sides, those were provisions that were being included. If they were going to go sue under eminent domain and take that easement under condemnation and purchase it that way, I don't know that those protections would have been in place. This law sets a guarantee that these terms must be included on behalf of the landowner. That's indemnity and holding harmless.
Your intention is not to put the thumb on the scale toward what company can come in or to make a value judgment on carbon capture pipelines themselves at all. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, and that's kind of it. I think a lot of folks, and boy, it causes me to scratch my head on exactly what the plan is here. I mean, I remember the first time I heard about this project, I called my wife and said, I think the plan is that they're going to pump carbon dioxide into a hole in the ground in North Dakota because that's going to save the planet. And I can understand why people scratch their head about that notion. But this bill had nothing to do with the federal laws that underpin basically the economics of this program. And I think a lot of people are frustrated about that. They think this is the Green New Deal. This is misguided federal legislation. So they're mad about the project overall. And I don't blame them for that. But this landowner bill of rights has nothing to do with that. Likewise, they're mad about eminent domain. And that was something that I took a big run at. I wrote the bill that we passed out of the House last year that would have clarified that this project did not qualify for eminent domain. That died unanimously in the Senate. It was defeated quickly and again completely. And so I kind of changed gears over the summer as I called senators, and there was no appetite for that change, and said, if we can't get that done, how are we going to protect these landowners when this project comes? And this is the product that came out of that, and I think it's something that, again, however you feel about this project, you should want these protections and benefits in place for the landowners in the counties.
So the idea of whether or not this project qualified for eminent domain has to do with whether it's a private company making money on it or whether it's a public utility?
So, you know, eminent domain is a term and a governmental power that not a lot of people are familiar with. It allows usually a government, but I would say in the last several decades, they've expanded who can use eminent domain to be able to purchase a property right from someone, whether they want to sell it or not. And that's really flying in the face of our free market system, which is predicated on willing buyer, willing seller. Eminent domain says otherwise, and it's been used historically. I mean, this dates back to the Magna Carta. They've had this authority to build roads, for example. I mean, the DOT can come in and say, our road is coming through your land, and you're either going to sell us that land or we're going to file a proceeding. We're going to pay you what the market rate is, and we're taking it anyway. Utilities have long had that, and you need those things. They have a clear public benefit. But, you know, I've often and long argued that we should really reserve this right for projects with clear public benefit. And right now, the South Dakota Supreme Court is hearing a challenge to whether or not this carbon pipeline has eminent domain authority based on, is it a commodity? If all you're doing is pumping it into a hole in the ground in North Dakota, is that a commodity? Those arguments, which were arguments that I made in committee and on the House floor a year ago, were heard in the South Dakota Supreme Court by landowner advocates. And so the Supreme Court is still to determine whether the statute, in fact, grants them that authority. But I'm interested in planning to spend the summer working on some aspects of eminent domain. I mean, it's still something that is near and dear to me. A part of our ranch was condemned through eminent domain when they built the dam, and they flooded it out and some of the land. And, of course, not just on our place, but I think 70% of the best Indian farm ground got flooded out in that. I mean, there's some real scars from that, but that was all seized by eminent domain as well. So it's something that's close to my heart and something I've got a lot of interest in. I knew that we couldn't get any changes in that area done this year, but it's not something that I'm giving up on. I mean, we're going to have a new legislature in next year, and I'm looking at a couple of different ways we can address that and make sure that it has a South Dakota approach to when we allow people to use that.
Talk a little bit about safety. How did you think about safety when you wrote this legislation or worked on it?
Yeah, you know, it's, I understand the trepidation. It's a new thing. It's a new thing. And not for the country. There have been thousands of miles of carbon dioxide pipelines elsewhere in the country. But for us, it's a new thing. And so you'll hear a lot that the carbon dioxide is heavier than the air and how it settles. And one thing about it is that the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, PHMSA, is a federal agency that is tasked in federal law with overseeing the safety of pipelines like this. And in fact, local governments and state government are preempted from trying to enact safety restrictions on this pipeline at all. I mean, it's federally preempted. In Iowa, some counties tried to do setbacks that were in excess of what PHMSA had set for a standard, and they were struck down. And they said, well, why was that struck down? Well, it's because you can't really come up with an argument for basically pipeline setback that doesn't have to do with safety, because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't hear it. I mean, there's really no orderly development argument there. And so they kept coming back to, well, it's really just about safety. They don't want to run it close in case there's a leak and it could hurt people. Well, that's preempted. And so then the federal the courts would strike that down. So when you talk about safety, that didn't weigh in as much because it's not an area where we could regulate. But I do grant the fears and concerns. Like anything new that's coming through, people are going to be fearful of what might happen if there is an explosion. I would tell you that it's a lot safer than moving any of these products by rail or by truck or anything like that. And so In this model, though, what we tried to do was require additional disclosure by the pipeline company that there is a plume study of what happens if there is a leak that the pipeline company refused to submit to the PUC, kind of famously and I think foolishly, that we said, no, you have to submit it to them, and the PUC has to release a summary of those results to try to quell some of those fears. I mean, I'm a pretty big advocate that sunshine is a great disinfectant. And so if there's information about what happens and how the county should be able to react to that, those emergency managers or your sheriff or any of these public safety officials, I think arming them with knowledge is most important on the safety side.
What's the timeline for that? When do they have to submit the plume study or the dispersion analysis to the commission, and when does the commission provide that to the public? Is it before it's built?
It's before it's permitted. It's part of the permit process. Okay. It's one of the last sections of the bill.
Yep.
But it's as part of their permit process, which I think those dockets last time were 9 months, 12 months, something like that. So it's an exhaustive. I mean, the PUC, I can't say enough about the folks who work there and really the commissioners. I mean, I think they've got a really difficult job. And they are in the posture of administrative law judges. I mean, they're there to look at the application, see if it meets the legal standards, and then make a determination. And I think they do a nice job, but it's a big job. I mean, they've got to look county by county. They got to look township by township of are there particular aspects of this county or this township, and which one of these ordinances do we put in place? And again, whether 201 is the law or not, they're making that analysis. They already have been. And so it's a pretty exhaustive process, that application for a PUC permit.
When you're working on some of this legislation, this is legislation, whether it's quantum computers or the future of Ellsworth Air Force Base or a pipeline that may or may not come through, and people are getting together and they're talking, they have a vision of who we are and a vision of who we want to be. These are people who are grappling with some enormous topics, but from a frame of mind of rural thinking, South Dakota values, a deep attachment to the land. What are you hearing thematically as some of these topics come up?
You know, I think a lot of it's about preservation, right? I mean, if you're somebody who really feels like if somebody told you this landowner bill of rights was the thing that like guaranteed that this project was going to go forward, and if only we could repeal this landowner bill of rights, then it wouldn't, right? I mean, if your whole goal is block the project, overregulate it until it goes away, that's your whole goal. I think the animating purpose and the reason that I am not maybe casting total aspersions on those people or something is that I think their animating goal is preservation, that they say, look, we know that it might mean our corn is worth less, and it might mean that our land is worth less or that we get less money, but we want things to stay just as they are and as they have been, or maybe to go back to the way they were. I sympathize with these folks, I suppose, in a way, and in particular on this eminent domain thing. I mean, you're just sitting there, and you're thinking about how to raise the next crop, and then you get this letter, and there's going to be something coming through your land you don't want. And I understand why there's an emotional reaction to that. I've felt it myself, and I might, you know, it's a scar that doesn't leave your family. I guess I'll say it that way. But I think that's the animating purpose. And on the other hand, I just think we want to be a state where you can still build things. I mean, we want to be a state where the speed limit is the same as you go across the state. And, you know, the degree to which this clarified the PUC's role and maybe strengthened it, well, again, they can still put these local ordinances into effect, but it did strengthen their hand a little bit. We had a protest culture on everything 75 years ago. We wouldn't have an interstate highway. If we had a protest culture on things, we would have never built and become the country that we are. I mean, Bill Jenkel wouldn't have been able to wire the schools with internet before anywhere else in the country did. And so this project and this carbon thing is something that I'm not that wild about. It seems a little goofy to me, I'll be honest about it, but I don't want it to be the marker to our state about who we are for the next 50 years, that we're done building things, we're not going to expand our electrical grid, we're not going to increase our broadband capacity, we're not going to move water across the state to people who need it. I mean, we need to be a state that can still build and do and become things. I mean, we want to be a state of makers, and we want to be a state that's still growing, not just in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, but everywhere. And I think the key to keeping it vibrant is having opportunity. So it's really a difficult thing because, you know, I sympathize with folks who want to preserve, but I'm worried that preservation leads to obsolescence.
There's more to this conversation. We'll put it on our website at sdpb.org/news. That's also where you can find all of SDPB's pipeline coverage. Let's take a moment now for poetry. April is National Poetry Month. Poets Joseph Bottom and Sally Thomas create a daily poetry newsletter on the online platform Substack. It's called Poems Ancient and Modern. We talked with the poets about the role of verse in our daily lives. That conversation was earlier in April. Now we'd like to bring you a bit of their original work. Here's Dr. Joseph Bottom.
So I'm Joseph Bottom, a South Dakota poet and writer. This is a tiny little epigram from my last book of poetry, Spending the Winter. It's called Bliss and Blunder, and it goes, "Worthless things and things of wonder are fish in a single lake, for much of bliss is caught by blunder and joy by some mistake." And this is the poem I wrote when I decided I would come back to South Dakota. And this was a poem from that moment. It's also in the book Spending the Winter, and it's called Homecoming. "Sometimes I dream I'm flying just above the plain, the world in wheat beneath me, the rivers rich with rain. And there I hear the murmur of what the old land knows. All journeys need an ending, all circles long to close."
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra takes the stage this weekend for a season finale and a party celebrating Maestro Delta David Geyer's 20 years of leadership. Cultural historian Joseph Horowitz is in town for the Concert Insights. That begins at 6:30 p.m. local time. Then Delta David Geyer conducts Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 3. I spoke with Geyer earlier this week.
I can't tell you how many times I've been stopped on the street or in the grocery store or whatever, and people saying, you know, every time I go hear the symphony, it seems like it gets better and better every time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, yeah, it's what we do. it just feels like we're going from strength to strength.
What does that sound like for you? Because you've been there for the 20 years. We're celebrating your 20 years with the symphony. Do you hear it? Do you see it?
Yeah, I think there's a deeper level of engagement across the board. Yeah, there's new personnel. The level of commitment to the orchestra, the organization is very strong. Our rehearsal schedule, when I look back to when I came, you know, our rehearsal schedule was spread out across an entire week, and with holes in it, you know, days off and that sort of thing. And now our rehearsal is super condensed. Like, our first rehearsal is Thursday night, and then we put the whole thing together in 48 hours, and it's done. So everybody has to come, like, totally prepared, because it's not about learning your part in the orchestra. It's about putting it together and making music together. And everybody comes together, you know, with a commitment to making things better every time. So that's really the key.
The national attention that this orchestra has gotten has meant something for audiences. It's meant something for donors who are excited to invest in the future of the community organization that is the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. What has it meant to the musicians to have that kind of acknowledgement for their boldness?
Well, I think there's a validation. I mean, there's many of us who've been, you know, on this journey for the last 20 years, you know, in building this thing together. And of course, there are musicians that were before that as well. Don't mean to poo-poo that at all. But, you know, in terms of my time here and, you know, just everybody stepping up their game, I think, you know, once Alex Ross wrote that piece in The New Yorker 2 years ago, like, it just opened a, you know, that was just a big rubber stamp, you know, on the organization saying, yeah, you know, go do great, more great work. And so that's what we're about. If you talk to our personnel manager, who actually lives in the Twin Cities, because, you know, over half our orchestra comes from the Twin Cities anyway, she'll tell you that the reason, there are two reasons that players want to come play in our orchestra. Number one is the repertoire, because our programming is so different from everybody else's. And number two is what she calls the hang. That it's just it's a great weekend with everybody. Like she's not just talking about, you know, grabbing a beer after rehearsal. She's talking about the atmosphere in the orchestra, in the rehearsals. We genuinely enjoy making music together. It's not just business. It's not just a gig. Like, we're all investing in this thing together.
Is that leadership from the section leaders, from the concertmaster?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, our full-time musicians, this Dakota String Quartet, Dakota Wind Quintet, those are our principals in the orchestra. So, yes, you know, definitely leadership from them. And they're all very strong and very well-respected.
I'm sorry, I called them section leaders. That's a high school term. Principals.
Well, yeah, but they do. They lead their sections, for sure. Uh-huh. And whether that's, you know, Dusuk sitting in front of 16 other violins, or whether it's, you know, Jeff Paul sitting with the two other oboists. I mean, it's still they're leading, you know. And you know, the fact that those nine musicians, that they make music together intimately all the time, makes all the difference in the world. Like, you're not just throwing a bunch of people together. Like, these musicians are very much aware of it. And that chamber music, you know, interaction that happens between those people in those ensembles then translates to the rest of the orchestra. It's palpable.
Yeah. They are composing. They are teaching. They have their own schools. They are volunteering and leading the community. They're in those conversations with the Lakota Music Project musicians. They're traveling the state.
Right.
They are, some of those stories are still so moving to me of coming here for the first time and saying, I'm never going to stay in this place. And then 20 years later, here you are, because it's your home.
Yeah, well, and the fact is that there's opportunity here, there's commitment, there's support from the community.
Yeah.
And the none of these things are a given with any symphony orchestra. And that's why I came in the first place. I mean, when I came as a candidate 20 years ago, last November, it was palpable, this community, the love for the orchestra, the support that it gave to the arts. It's like, yeah, I can build something here. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think that's what I was looking for. I didn't think I'd find it in South Dakota, but I wasn't finding it in New Jersey. I wasn't finding it in Westchester County or Connecticut, but I found it here.
Yeah. When you had doubts, I'm going to assume, because you're a human being, that there were days or even weeks where you had doubts. What made you stay and push to do the next thing?
Well, I wasn't alone, you know, and people were depending on me. I was hired to lead. And I remember I had a particularly down moment when Scott Lawrence was president, and we were in his office at Lawrence and Schiller, and the end of that conversation was, David, get out there and lead. I've got your back. And nobody had ever said that to me before, you know. That was like 10 years into the job. So, like, it was just like, you know, stop worrying. I've got your back. And that was a game changer for me. It was, you know, real confidence. Yeah.
Let's talk about this season finale and the Mahler Symphony number 3.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk a long time about Mahler.
I could. Till the cows come home,
as they
say. This is
one of your fingerprints. One of the things that I know you of is the Mahler rotation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done the complete cycle already. So 2 years ago, I was sitting on Jen Teisinger's patio, and that's our executive director, and we were planning this season we're in now. And she's like, oh, David, you know, it's your 20th anniversary. What's your party piece? I said, I get a party piece? She said, of course you get a party piece. And one piece popped in my head, and I kept pushing it out because we'd already done it. We'd already played the complete Mahler cycle. I've always been about expanding the repertoire of this orchestra, make us more than just another regional orchestra. But in the end, she said, it's your party. I'm like, okay, this is the piece that I really, really love. So
yeah,
let's do this. And it's a party piece for a conductor. All Mahler symphonies are like a concerto for the conductor. Like there's so much to interpret. It's so rich, so much more so than, Beethoven symphonies and whatnot. Like you just really, it's just a joy to dig into these massive works, but it's also a party piece because there's going to be 100 people in the orchestra on stage, plus the choirs, and it's a big fest,
Yeah. What do you mean by there's so much for the conductor to interpret? Help me understand that.
Well, I mean, Mahler's day job was as a conductor, maybe the most prominent conductor in the world. At the turn of the last century in Vienna. And he also spent 2 years in New York at the New York Philharmonic Metropolitan Opera. So he composed in such a way that explored possibilities in the orchestra that other composers had not really explored before. It just opened up all these, all these possibilities for the conductor to really dig in and interpret. So I studied with Leonard Bernstein at one point, and for a long time, Leonard Bernstein was my go-to for Mahler. As a matter of fact, when we started our Mahler cycle here, I was still an assistant at New York Philharmonic. So every time we would do a Mahler symphony, I would go to the New York Philharmonic archives and pull out Bernstein's scores and transfer his markings into my score.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, but then, I grew beyond that. Mahler started to become my own. I didn't need so much to go to Bernstein, for his.
I need to know what that moment, what some of those moments were like, where you were like, was it a slow fading away? Or were you looking at the score and saying, I want to do something different than what Bernstein did.
Yeah,
there.
That was the gradual process. Like there were several. I mean, Bernstein was always known for being overindulgent, and like putting his stamp on every single piece he did, whether he should have or not, And I started to feel that, like, I don't think that's what Mahler intended here, and then one day, somebody handed me a DVD of Claudio Abbado conducting Mahler 7 and then the Lucerne Festival. And that was also a watershed moment for me. I mean, I knew that Abbado was, I'd heard Abbado's recordings from back in the 80s and so on. But this, at the very end of his life, in the Lucerne Festival, which is a hand-picked orchestra, everybody who wanted to play with Claudio, and like he had non-orchestral players. You had the Hagen String Quartet. You had Zabina Meyer, who was the preeminent clarinet soloist. But they're sitting in the orchestra because they want to play with Claudio. And it's palpable. And you see, not just the interaction, the performance, but his interpretation of it was just so freeing, so light. I mean, you've got 100 people playing, and yet it's somehow light and breezy, this music. And the camera pans out, and the string section looks like a South Dakota wheat field blowing in the summer. I mean, it was astonishing to experience. And I'm like, okay, I need to tap into that.
Yeah.
So I started rethinking. I'm not saying I copied Abbado, but I took such great inspiration from, basically going deeper into Mahler's score and not mm-hmm. worrying so much about how other people had interpreted it,
Yeah.
And you get to a point where you don't want to hear anybody else's interpretation of a piece but your own, because you own it.
Yeah.
I don't need to hear anybody else now. So, yeah.
I love that. What a rich description. Thank you for that.
Sure. Yeah. But this Mahler symphony has always been my favorite from the first time I heard it as a pup.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Just like, and I was a trumpet player back then, and there's a trumpet call at the very beginning. That it's a minor triad with a major seventh, and I heard it, and it's like, wait, you can do that? Like, what? It's like, that's just mind-blowing. And what this man could do with a diminished seventh chord, oh my gosh, you know, like that's in the weeds for our listeners here, I know, but it's just like, you know, it was mind-blowing, obviously.
Everybody has something that they can relate to in their life, in their profession,
yeah,
where they reach that moment and they're like, I cannot believe it's that elegant, whether it's a physician or a teacher or a radio broadcaster, where you're like, oh, yeah, I want that. That feeling when all of a sudden it clicks.
Mm.
That's the...
Nothing like it.
Yeah. How do you prepare for it? I mean, I just think when I'm watching, I just think of the physical endurance and I think of the focus and the concentration and the preparation. Do you think about those things? What are you thinking about before you take the stage?
Well, it's you try to get beyond all of that, right? And that is the preparation, so that you don't have to think about that stuff. And then it's a little bit like flying without a net, you know, by the time you get there. But like, so we did this third Mahler symphony like 15 years ago, and I haven't touched it since.
Yeah.
So I've been working on this piece since August, you know, and it's
going to be all different 15 years ago if you did it, right?
For all of us.
Yeah.
I mean, my Mahler 3 will be better this time, I'm sure. And I can tell you also for sure that the South Dakota Symphony's Mahler 3 will be at a higher level this time around.
What's a mistake for you? What would be a mistake, theoretically? If you get done with the performance and you think, I would like those two bars back, what would you want back?
Oh, that happens every concert,
okay,
Lori.
Give us
on
an example. We're inside your brain right now, and it's,
you know,
making me happy.
It's an unclear cue that caused a little kerfuffle in the orchestra for a bar or two or something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, conductors don't like to talk about it, but the orchestra covers for us now and again,
right,
particularly when you're doing stuff from memory.
Yeah.
You know, but it happens, you know. And
Are you doing this from memory?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could, yeah, the score would just get in the way at this point. Yeah. Honestly, it's just, yeah. It's a big one. It's 100 minutes long, this symphony.
That's the partnership. That's the collaboration. So 100 minutes long from memory, and the orchestra is with you, following you.
Yeah.
But you're also in this together.
Yeah.
More than 100 musicians, packed house.
And don't forget the audience, because as I, you know, I mean, we feel it, but I try to give voice to it that, you know, we're a community on stage. You know, we've been rehearsing, but the community is really the audience. And I think because it's an acoustic-based musical experience, it's a different kind of experience. There's nothing in between you and the audience. And then those silent moments, you can hear the audience breathe. You can feel their energy. You know, and Dusuk, you know, we feed off of it, you know, this kind of engagement. And there are times you can just hear a pin drop, you know, with 1,500 people in the hall, you know, it's magical.
The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra and the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra Chorus perform Saturday, April 27th at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Concert Insights begin at 6:30 local time. The concert is at 7:30. SDPB provides the live stream for the performance at sdpb.org/live. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer and director of SDPB's journalism is Kara Hetland. Josh Chilson is SDPB's news director. Jordan Henderson is our videographer, and Colton Nicholson is our engineer. Special thanks this week and every week to the SDPB crews in the Black Hills and in Vermilion. Thank you for helping our guests feel comfortable on every side of the river. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.